Welcome to the Capital Connection, a weekly program questioning New York State leaders on a variety of issues. Your host is Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Distribution for the Capital Connection is made possible with the help of New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us this week is Casey Seiler, state editor and Capital Bureau chief for the Albany Times Union, and as good as they come. Welcome, Casey.
Alan, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Let's start with the obvious, the Moreland Act Commission.
I thought that might be what you wanted to talk about.
Well, I mean, this is, I believe, an uncharacteristic, real misstep by the Cuomo administration. Perhaps you could fill us in.
The governor last July convened a 24-member Moreland Commission panel. The Moreland Act is a century-old state law that allows the governor to investigate any body, board, agency, you name it. And because of the way that money is spent around the state, it basically means that the governor can investigate, you know, any kind of industry, any aspect of state government. An open question is whether or not the governor could use it to go directly after a co-equal, you know, branch of government, such as the legislature. He convened it in response to the legislature's inaction on his ethics reform package, which in turn was introduced in response to last spring's, you know, what's become known as the springtime for scandal in Albany. We're coming up on, I think last week we marked the one-year anniversary of the indictments of Assemblyman Eric Stevenson, the resignation of Assemblyman Nelson Castro, who apparently wore a wire for the feds due to the fact that he had his own perjury troubles. Then, of course, in June came Malcolm Smith and John Sampson, I believe it was May or June. It just seemed, as the governor has said, it seemed like every day brought a new revelation. So the legislature fails to act, and the governor says, okay, fine, I told you what was going to happen. I'm going to convene a Moreland Commission on Public Ethics, which was given a very broad mandate, 24 members, a lot of district attorneys, including Albany County's David Soares. And then we're off to the races. They were deputized by Attorney General Eric Schneiderman as deputy attorneys general, which meant that they could issue subpoenas if the three co-chairs agreed. And what, of course, ensued was a fall of kind of back and forth, first requests to the legislature for information about lawmakers' outside income, then sort of bank shot subpoenas to many of their employers, including a lot of law firms. It got a lot of pushback from lawmakers. I think it could be summed up in a quote from Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver, like the governor, a Democrat, I believe about 2 months ago, who said the Moreland Commission is embarked on a fishing expedition designed to intimidate lawmakers to get the governor's way on his ethics reform package. Now, as a result, in December, the Moreland panel put out its preliminary report, which recommended basically all the things that the governor had recommended back in the spring. To the point where, I mean, you could go down through the two press releases and everything lined up on in terms of the recommendations. And then the Moreland Commission went fairly quiet once the legislative session began, clearly because the governor didn't want all that noise, all that static getting in the way of, you know, work on the budget. And then, of course, at the end of March, we have the agreement on the budget deal. On the day after the deal was made, the governor revealed, it was a Saturday, in a teleconference with reporters, including myself, that the Moreland Commission was going to go away, that it was going to be mothballed because the governor had declared victory on many pieces of his ethics reform package. New crimes for corrupting the government, a new definition of bribery that will make it easy for prosecutors to bring cases against corrupt public officials, a lifetime ban for public officials who are found guilty of corruption, and of course, most controversially, what was described as a demonstration project for public financing of campaigns. This means a public match for small donors that kind of multiplies the power of small money in campaigns. The public demonstration project, as opposed to the original proposal for all legislative races, governor, controller, and attorney general, will now simply be limited to the controller's race, not 4 years down the road, but this year in 2014, which good government groups said was going to be almost impossible to implement, to administrate, especially because it's going to be handled by the Board of Elections. Another thing the governor got was an independent enforcement entity within the Board of Elections that he will be naming in the near future.
He'll be naming, but only with the confirmation of both houses.
With the say-so, yeah, with the approval of the Senate and the Assembly. That is that the longest answer you've ever received to a question on the show?
I think it was one of the best answers I've ever received. Casey, it was wonderful. Now, let's go back a little bit in some of what you said. He wants people to think, the governor, that he wants reform. And yet, some of the reforms that he gained were hardly earth-shattering. I mean, the idea that if somebody was convicted of bribery, that you have a lifetime ban against them. How many of those guys are coming back anyway? You know what I'm saying?
Well, actually, quite a few of them. I mean, we've seen in the state legislature that second acts, to paraphrase Fitzgerald, are beloved sometimes. You've seen corrupt public officials who have, in fact, come back, often to kind of reabuse.
You use the word often, but I mean...
Occasionally.
Yeah. So I believe he gets a lot out of that. But the real question is, does this governor really want reform? That's the question.
Well, in a recent column, I noted that good government groups have come to the conclusion that the governor is very vocal about their issues and will push for them right up until it's time to kind of make the deal. And the governor will always make the deal, and the chips that are thrown into the pot, as it were, are quite often the big issues that ethics reform advocates want to see. In 2012, we saw it happen to independent redistricting, the independent redistricting process, the once every 10 years redrawing of
that
the state's political lines.
I'm sorry, Casey, he promised as part of his campaign that he was going to do away with letting them draw their own districts.
Correct. And good government groups, of course, wanted to see it happen for the redistricting process that happened in 2012.
Sure.
In March 2012, the governor and legislative leaders struck upon what we call a big ugly, meaning a kind of universal field theory deal that includes lots of stuff, fiscal stuff, ethics stuff, you name it. And instead of kind of pure redistricting plan, what we got was a kind of mixed plan that allows the legislature to kind of keep its hands in on the redistricting process a little bit less directly. And that process will not take place until the redistricting of 2022.
Which means a lot of them will have moved on. It'll be on somebody else's watch.
Exactly.
And some of them may even be dead.
Well, I hope we're all here, though. So, in other words, good government reform advocates have begun to look at the governor's actions as opposed to his words.
Yeah.
And now, of course, the governor has got the U.S. attorney looking into the demise.
Let's talk about that.
Right.
U.S. attorneys, of course, in case people don't know, are often named by the senior senator of their party if they are in control of their house. In this case, Preet Bharara has been named, we think, we have every reason to believe, by Chuck Schumer.
Yeah, or certainly with his recommendation. But Preet Bharara has been around for quite a while.
Yeah, but he was chief of staff for Schumer, wasn't he?
Yes, as many members of Cuomo's team have come through Chuck Schumer's shop as well.
Yeah, but not Cuomo himself.
No.
The reason I mention this is not to necessarily cause trouble, but it would appear that if Preet Bharara is now, and you're going to tell us about it, going after Cuomo on the Moreland Act and not following through on that and disbanding the Moreland Act Commission, how many of us believe there may have been a telephone call either between Schumer and Bharara or between somebody on their staff?
Well, so the basic facts are about 9-10 days after the budget was passed, after it was announced that the Moreland Commission was going to go bye-bye, Preet Bharara sent a letter to the disbanding Moreland Commission and said, I am concerned that your demise after only 9 months, as opposed to the 18 months that the commission was supposed to run, created the appearance that an investigation of value to the people of New York State is being stopped as part of a political negotiation, which, of course, is not appearance. That's actually what happened. Now, the governor has said, look, I always made it clear to the members of the Moreland panel, you're either going to complete this investigation or we're going to have a significant deal on these issues. And, of course, what happened, the governor would say, is the latter. So the U.S. Attorney's Office sent a truck over to the offices of the Moreland panel to collect copies of all all of their records. And Preet-Bharara gave a radio interview on WNYC where he kind of scoffed at the argument that was issued by Larry Schwartz, the governor's secretary, that, gosh, we got a lot of great stuff out of this deal, and refused to rule out, Preet-Bharara did, the possibility that he would look into accusations of improper meddling by the Cuomo administration that have been reported by a number of outlets, I think notably and early on by Ken Lovett of the Daily News, who said that the governor's staff was kind of throwing its weight around on the decisions on
who to subpoena
or who not to subpoena in the case of the Real Estate Board of New York, a major contributor to the governor.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Let's just say that again, a major contributor to the governor. And then the governor has how much in his campaign account right now?
$33 million as of the most recent filing.
So why, if you have $33 million, and if you did have campaign financing, as in the case he suggested of the comptroller's race, he would have to give up upward of 60% of the money he had collected. Why in the world would the governor be for campaign reform, even though he says he is?
Well, that was a question raised by many people as a result of the comptroller-only deal. Now,
that comptroller, by the way, who everybody knows, the governor.
Tom DiNapoli.
Yes, has no use for.
A frosty relationship with.
Well, I'm a big fan of our comptroller. I think he does his job. I think he does it well. He's not politicizing it all over the place. He's not Machiavellian. But for some reason, Cuomo seems to have it out for him.
There is definitely a chilliness in their relationship, and I think it's similar to the one that the governor has to Attorney General Eric Schneiderman as well. I think it's no surprise, considering that you have seen Schneiderman and DiNapoli ally themselves on things like investigations, many of which have borne real fruit in terms of waste of taxpayer dollars. Of course, Tom DiNapoli said within days of the budget deal being struck that he would not, as they say, opt in to the demonstration project, as they put it. That he thought it was going to end up being a real kind of dog's breakfast in terms of implementation and also the kind of basic fairness of at this really pretty, I know it's only April, but it's fairly well along in the election cycle. He has been raising money according to the existing rules for, you know, more than 3 years now.
But we're not talking about a lot of money. We're talking about $1 million, something like that.
I think he's got, I think he's got a little bit more than that, but he would have to give up a lot of it.
Two-thirds of it.
Good government groups, by the way, have not only supported him in his decision not to opt in, but they have, in fact, actively demanded, a couple of them, that he not opt in, which they fear would legitimize what they see as a bad plan, as a less than half a loaf, a crumb of moldy bread, I think is the way that Blair Horner of the New York Public Interest Research Group described it.
I have two questions for you, Casey Seiler. Number one, what's a dog's breakfast?
A dog's breakfast is a mess of a lot of different ingredients.
Oh, yeah. Not my dog.
Now I'm going to have to go look it up to make sure I'm using it properly.
Not my dog. Not Murray the dog. So he only gets the best.
It's true. Dogs these days eat almost better than, you know, unfortunately, a lot of humans. So.
But we digress. And so I guess the real question to me is, did Andrew Cuomo make some misassessments here in your mind politically? Look, he's very clever. I have written columns. They didn't like them, calling him Machiavellian or... But did he make a mistake? Did he think he was going to get away with this?
I think he misjudged the amount of difficulty that a really broad-based Moreland Commission would make for him, meaning for his relationship with the legislature. And I think he misjudged potentially his own ability or his administration's inability to not mess with the inner workings of the Moreland Commission. That has resulted in more bad press than the commission's actual investigations, which apparently have turned up potentially, as William Fitzpatrick, who's one of the co-chairs, a Republican district attorney from Onondaga County, has said, many things that are embarrassing, but potentially not a lot that is actually criminal or would result in criminal prosecutions, although apparently they have done good work on lawmakers' abuse of the per diem system, money that they get for coming up to Albany.
So my question still remains, and we can move on to other things, but my question still remains. He wanted a Moreland Act Commission. He appointed it. He's got $33 million, at least in the bank himself. He takes money from people like the real estate industry, which you just mentioned. And so was it just that he wanted the appearance of, and I guess I'm asking myself this rhetorically.
Well, yeah. What the governor has said is that it is unacceptable for the state not to act in some way on these ethics problems. It is very difficult for the governor to run. And he also points out that it's difficult for the people of New York State to believe in their government when there's this constant, you don't even want to call it a drip, drip, drip. It's more like an open sewer pipe of cases of graft and public corruption. Of course, Rob Astorino, the Republican Westchester County executive, who is now the only announced Republican candidate against the governor, has lambasted the state of ethics in New York, saying, you know, it's the most corrupt government in America, which is not exactly backed up by the records, but it depends on what metric you use.
Yeah, that's ridiculous. But anyway, he's saying it and he's running on
it. It's up there, though.
But he's saying it and he's running on it.
Correct. One of many things he's running on, in addition to, you know, the governor's kind of hand-wringing over hydrofracking and especially the economic condition of upstate.
You mentioned it. The health commissioner, Dr. Shaw, has just moved on. He was the guy who was charged with studying hydrofracking till it went away. Clearly the governor was for it. In the beginning, he got bit in the posterior by a huge alliance of people who didn't want to, quote, poison the water, and he sort of backed off. He couldn't really back off. He gave it first to the Department of Environmental Conservation, and then he gave it to the hapless Dr. Shore.
The way I describe it is the hydrofracking, the construction of the potential regulatory, you know, scaffolding for hydrofracking is now like a series of Russian nesting dolls.
Yeah.
You've got the DEC waiting on, you've got the industry and the governor waiting on the Department of Environmental Conservation to come up with its sort of final blueprint for the regulation. That is now waiting for the health department's review of the very significant chapter on the potential health impacts of hydrofracking. And what Dr. Shaw has said is that, well, I'm waiting until a lot of these big reports come out. I've spoken to a lot of the researchers, and you know, it is possible that that is the case, but in a state that is still, according to all the polls, very, very evenly split on the question of hydrofracking, although there are, of course, regional divides among that data, it is a lose-lose situation for the governor. On one side, he risks, offending or threatening or letting down pro-business forces, and of course you've got a very, very vocal, very, very well-organized environmental community on the other side.
The governor has, of course, the signature SAFE Act came out after the horrors of the Connecticut children being murdered, and I thought it was one of his more courageous things that he would do. The people of New York State, by large numbers, approve of gun control, although upstate it's less obvious than it is in New York City. So does he lose because he wanted so much to get a huge vote out for him in upstate New York, and this took a bite out of him?
Yeah, I think he knew that he was going to get that very vocal anti-SAFE Act reaction. We're talking the week that the deadline for the owners of previously legal, now banned assault weapons are required to either register with the state or modify their weapons so they're not out of compliance with the SAFE Act. What you're hearing is a number of people are simply, and we're unsure how many, are just simply not going to comply, that they're going to engage in civil disobedience. Of course, it's only a misdemeanor not to register it with the state. But it remains to be seen how much it's going to cost the governor votes or potentially people just staying home, especially in certain parts of upstate where there's a real enthusiasm for the Second Amendment, lots of hunters, lots of people who have grown up around guns. But of course, as you point out, there is still a majority of people statewide who support the SAFE Act and who believe in stricter gun limits, especially after things like Newtown that you mentioned and the killings that happened only a couple of days later outside of Webster. and terrible shootings that cost the lives of two public safety officers.
Let's talk a little bit about charter schools. The governor comes out and announces, some people thought, put more weight behind them than one might have expected for charter schools in New York State. There are some cynics who say he did it because many of the Wall Street types who support individual charter schools put the muscle on them, but we don't really know that. And I'm just wondering what you think.
Well, another possibility is that the support of charter schools was a perfect kind of counterbalance to the press, the push by New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio for a surcharge on the wealthy in the city to pay for the expansion of universal pre-K or for universal pre-K down in the city. Well, if you go back to his State of the State speech, the mention of charter schools is exactly zero. Although, of course, in that same speech, the governor said the state would move forward and the state would fund, without a surcharge, the expansion of pre-K. And, of course, that was part of the budget. $340 million for pre-K this year, the vast majority of it, $300 million, going to the city, essentially saying to Mayor de Blasio, all right, you said you wanted this money. You said you can get these programs up and running. Here you go. The money is going to be reimbursable. So, in other words, the city won't be getting a check for $300 million. They will actually have to get these programs up and running, and then the state, if these programs are seen as viable, more than, as the governor has put it, just kind of daycare in an educational setting, the city will be paid back. Only $40 million for programs outside of the five boroughs. What the governor has said is that as school districts come online with these programs, more money will be available to them. But certainly a big chunk of that money is going to New York City.
Very quickly, because we only have a couple of minutes left, casinos. The governor seems to want casinos in upstate New York as a way of generating more income, more jobs. Now we hear that there may be one right off the thruway as you come into Albany.
Right. What is what's become described as the Exit 23 project, which is just south of downtown Albany, is increasingly being seen as one of the most viable proposals and real competition for the push by the Saratoga, what's known as a Racino, the Harness Track Casino, which would like to see the Capital Region license. We're talking about four casinos that are going into three zones across upstate, and they'll have exclusivity for several years before any the three other casinos are constructed. It's likely that those three other casinos will go downstate. So we're hearing a lot about that that project, which is being put together by a guy named David Flaum, with some collaboration. It's still kind of unclear what that partnership will take with Capital District OTB, the off-track betting operation. And what's said is that with the involvement of OTB, the money that flows to OTB will end up getting spread across a broader geographic area. So, and of course, in Saratoga, there's a very active protest push against the Racino's bid for one of these licenses.
Casey Seiler, it's always wonderful to see you here. I know that you're working really hard. You're the Capital Bureau Chief for the Times Union, and you know as much about state government as anybody that I know. So we want to thank you for being here, taking the time, and for joining us.
Alan, thanks for having me on. It's always great to talk to you.
The Capital Connection is distributed with the cooperation of the public radio stations of New York State. David Gastina is the producer of The Capital Connection, a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.